History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that really ought to be heard, and that's never going to happen unless we take the time to ask a few questions and listen to what comes back our way. Today I'm in Tracy, California, continuing our mission to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we sure learn a lot, don't we? We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. In Tracy, California, I'm joined by 92-year-old John Fitizoff, originally from San Francisco, California. And John, you grew up there with your brother, and your parents had immigrated to our country from Russia, is that right?
Russia. Yes, they came here in the early 1900s.
Did you hear some stories about that journey or why they came or how difficult it was for them?
Well, yeah, I mean, what happened is they came to the United States, and like people normally do, they always cluster around other Russians that came to the United States. So they came to a huge colony in San Francisco. Matter of fact, there were three churches of different denominations. There was the Malacan, the Bruhini, and the Baptist. And then out in the avenue, Geary Boulevard, there was another big colony of Russians, and that was the Pravoslavny. And I understand the church is still standing and had the onion domes on it, like the churches in Moscow. Yeah, so they settled there, and I was born there, and I wasn't going to die. I wound up with Tracy.
So growing up in a Russian colony, as you describe it, in San Francisco, you probably had most of your friends were Russian. You probably spoke Russian.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I used to speak Russian fluently. But then I lost a lot of it because my mother passed away over 50 years ago. And so there was no communication. And just like anything else, you know, if you don't do it enough, you begin to lose it.
Well, what was that childhood like growing up? Did you and your brother kind of hang together?
No, he was 7 years older than I was, and he had different interests than me. I was playing with marbles and stuff like that, and he was interested in girls.
I imagine that San Francisco has changed a little bit in the last 90 years. What are the things you remember about that area then as a boy? I mean, you were there when they started building the Golden Gate Bridge, huh?
That's right. Yeah, I watched that. It was altogether different. It was a community. It was a Russian community, and they had all these mom-and-pop stores were all Russian. I mean, they were run by Russians. We never locked the doors on our house, you know, or people that had cars. They never locked their cars up or nothing. It was a whole different ball game than it is now. I mean, now you got to keep looking over the shoulder to see if there might be somebody ready to do a job on you, you know.
Did you and your family feel the effects of the Great Depression there, or not so much?
Oh, now you're getting into a real good subject, you know. I remember the Depression really, really, really well. My mother, that whole community was all Russian. And they had actually in San Francisco, they had, I think it was two Russian daily papers or three. But the two that I remember is the Novy Zara and the Novosti. And that was printed in Russian. They were daily papers. That tells you how many Russians, you know, that there were in San Francisco. And also, at that particular time, the communist recruiters were real heavy in San Francisco because of the Russian population. And they came around, they figured, well, you know, they'd knock on the door and you'd answer it and they'd say, can we speak to the head of the household? In those days, I was the man. The father would answer the door and he'd say, well, why don't you invite some people over your house? And if you do, we'll bring some ice cream and cookies. Now, when he said ice cream and cookies, my antenna went up, because I was, I remember, eating oatmeal for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and these guys were going to come over with ice cream and cookies, so I started scouting the neighborhood to see which ones were going to have these presentations that the communists were going to get. So I have a real understanding and a real working of what the Communist Party intends for the United States, and I'm telling you, it's a sorry one, and they're right on target.
Well, and I guess I have to ask, too, your family was here in the States, but did you have relatives that were still back home under that Soviet regime?
Oh, yeah, we had some relatives that were back there, but you lose communications, you know.
But, you know, for most Americans, you know, World War II started December 7th, 1941, but you were probably aware of what was happening back in, you know, your parents' homeland.
Oh, yeah, there were still some of these old-timers, Russians that were came over, and that's when, after the war, things got a little hot and heavy between the Russians and America, and I went down to Los Angeles to a funeral, not another big, large community of Russians down in Los Angeles. I was invited over to Nashville, you know, they invite you over to their house to have a little borscht, you know. So, you know, these old-timers, they'd say, you know, they knew that, you know, I was at war and my brother was at war. And they said, you know, if we have a war with Russia, are you going to go fight Russia? Because you may have relatives. And I remember saying, well, I don't know. If they start shooting at me, I'm going to shoot back at them. So they weren't too happy with that.
Well, take me back to, let's say, the 30s and the start of the 1940s. So you're a young man turning into a teenager. Do you have ambitions, hopes and dreams, thoughts of, hey, when I grow up, here are the things I'm going to do with my life?
Yeah, you know, naturally you all had dreams, but I don't really remember. I was just busy growing up. The older I got, the more interested I got in girls. So I had a lot of dreams there.
What do you remember about December 7th? How did you find out that the Japanese had attacked at Pearl Harbor?
We were in Roosevelt Theater, and we came out of the show, and we heard people whooping down the street, you know, hollering Japanese, you know, attacked us. And, you know, I said, well, maybe a bunch of baloney, but when we finally got home and everybody, when they finally solidified the story, why, you know, that was it, man. I was ready to go.
How did things change in San Francisco after that? I mean, did your lives change, the way you had to go about your daily lives, things you had to do or watch out for?
No, it was, you know, there was a lot of work, and people were people. It was just, San Francisco is really a good city.
I've talked to people who were in that area at that time, and it sounds like there was some real concern for people living in San Francisco and the Bay Area at the time that the Japanese might attack there, that there might be an invasion or bombings there.
Oh, yeah, that got to be a real, you know, area where, you know, my wife was telling about her father, the sirens went off and they had a blackout, and her father was at those times there were street wardens, you know, to go around to see if the curtains were blacked out or anything, and he couldn't find his pants. By the time he found the fifth pair of pants, he got the all clear sign. Yeah, everybody was concerned, and as far as, like I said, Japanese, you know, you weren't sure. You didn't know, you know. All you saw on the papers is the atrocities that were being caused by a lot of the Japanese soldiers, especially like that stuff on Guadalcanal. There was a hollowed grounds, and I was there twice. You start talking to a Marine about, you know, boy, and he lowers his head. That's, like I say, sacred ground.
Well, and so you were just 15 when Pearl Harbor happened, but as you said, your brother was 7 years older. So I'm guessing he was involved in the war before you were.
Oh, yeah, and he was working at Bethlehem Steel, that's the shipyards there, and he got to be a specialist on riveting gun mounts. I understand, as the story goes, that this one foreman was on his back because they deferred him because of the specialty on the kind of work he was doing in the shipyards. And he was always on my brother's back. So one day He came to work and he handed his badge to his foreman. He says, here. And the foreman says, what are you doing? And he says, well, I just signed up to go in the Army. He said, I can't take, you know, this harassment anymore. So that's what he did. He went in the Army.
Was that hard for you to see him go overseas? Did you wonder if he was coming back?
No, hell no. I was going to go, baby. Give me a gun. Let's go. Yeah, it was, no, everybody was really charged up. Everybody had their batteries going. Everybody wanted to go. Matter of fact, I had a heck of a job persuading my mother to let me go into the Merchant Marine. Because you can go to Merchant Marine, you know, when you're 17 years old. Because they needed the Merchant Marine, because as Roosevelt knew, and he told them that when the war was coming to a close and they were working on a GI Bill, he told them, whatever you do, be sure you put the Merchant Marine in that GI Bill. And after the war was over, they forgot all about us. And Roosevelt told him, he says, if without the Merchant Marine, he says, I doubt whether we would have been able to win the war. And if we did, it would have been a long one, because everything that they had in the Pacific and in the Atlantic, you had to have the ships to bring the men and materials. Everything from a toothpick to a tank had to move by ships. And that's why the Merchant Marine in World War II had the biggest kill rate in World War II. It was 1 in 26, and then came the Marine Corps with 1 in 34, and then up the ladder. But a lot of people didn't realize that.
Yeah, and within every branch of service, there are more dangerous jobs than others. But you're saying if you take each branch separately, the Army, Navy, Marines, Coast Guard, Army Air Corps at that time, and the Merchant Marines, that being in the Merchant Marines was the most dangerous branch of service you could have chosen.
Yeah, it was the Pacific where the numbers run up, because in the Atlantic, I mean, they can sink the ship, and most, just about everybody didn't make it. Once they were in the water, even if they got into a lifeboat, they'd freeze to death.
Why was that so important to you? Why were you so determined to talk your mother into letting you sign up for the Merchant Marines?
Here's where the strange part of this whole story comes in. I kept telling my mother, I want to go over there and I want to meet Jim. I want to meet Jim. So sure enough, when we got over there and I met him.
Tell me the story. How'd you pull that off?
We pulled out of Australia with troops with their equipment and stuff. They were moving out of Australia. And then because there were still Japanese on New Guinea. And this island, good enough, was just off the tip of that. It was just a little dot on the map. And so anyway, well, I got to meet him there in Good Enough Island.
There's a photograph, and I'll put this online at hometownheroesradio.com, of you two brothers. You've got your arm around him, and man, that's a baby face you're wearing there, just a teenager with your older brother. And that's on Good Enough Island, as you described. But you didn't know that you were going to find him there. Tell me how that unfolded.
Yeah, well, my mother signed up for me to join the Merchant Marine, got on the ship, took off, wound up in Australia, unloaded the stuff, and then we went up to a town. That's where they were camped up there, because Australia was the staging area for World War with the Japanese. So we picked up these troops and their equipment, and we were taking it up to the rest of his outfit. They were meeting up with him. I was walking on a deck, and there was a soldier there, and I said, boy, I said, I sure hope I can meet with my brother. And he says, what outfit was he with? And I said, well, it was, I think, Company B, 3rd Engineer, Combat Engineers, 24th Division. He says, hell, he says, that's our outfit. We're going to go up and meet him. And I said, wow, boy, this is something.
It would be something, and it wouldn't be the only time. But not all of them were under the happiest of circumstances. Hear about their reunions and how his brother earned the Purple Heart when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.